baby. She has a little girl, I believe. Anjali's threat wrings me breathless. I raise my dagger to slice away her sneer, and she summons a wall of wind between us, halting my opening to strike her. Satisfied that I cannot touch her, she twirls a chakram, a circular throwing blade, around her wrist and switches her gaze to Ashwin. Decide quickly, Prince. My father will kill a Rani every hour starting at sunup unless he hears that you're dead. All warmth drains from Ashwin's pallor. He opens his mouth, his dry lips sticking together.
Are you certain this will stop Uduk?
I slice my blade in front of him. You cannot consider this. Hastin is trying to frighten you into conceding your throne, and the only way to do that is through your death. Anjali laughs lightly. Oh, let the prince die. It's his right. Quiet, I snap. Ashwin, we cannot believe anything she says. Hastin has the palace, and he's afraid you'll win it back. This must be a trick.
But if it isn't, he asks,
then we'll find another way.
Your friends will be killed,
he whispers, holding the machete at his side.
My father's wives, my family, will die.
My throat aches, thinking of the Ranis and Asha, my servant. Hastin could kill them no matter what Ashwin does or does not do. They are innocents, bystanders in this race for power. But they are more than prisoners. Every one of them is a sister warrior by heart and deed. As such, they would relinquish their lives to protect their families and their homeland's future. They aren't the rightful Raja, you are. I scrub away the flaking henna on the backs of my hands. As the kindred, I'll stand at your right-hand side. Ashwin sees my rank marks, and tears flood his eyes. Please give me the machete, I say. With my guidance, he gradually lowers the blade. Now let it go. He does not, so I pry the weapon away. He gasps for a saving breath, his chin quivering against more tears. Anjali ejects a sigh and stops twirling her chakram. You never know when to lose, Kalinda. My instincts prickle. I back up for the trees. Ashwin, get to the temple. He pivots to run, but before he takes a single step, Anjali slings a chakram at him, boosted by one of her vicious gusts. I knock Ashwin down away from its path. The chakram whirs off into the forest and embeds itself in a tree trunk. We scramble up, and Anjali hurls a follow-up wind at us, flinging us back. I land hard in the snow and drop the machete. Ashwin flies into a log, hitting his head, and lies in a daze. I throw up a flame, a signal to Inda and Pons, and draw my dagger. As I stand, I notice Anjali has disappeared. The sun has sunk, and the dusky twilight rapidly fades to dark. I scan the shadowed landscape for her. The northern winds blast, each gust stronger than the last. I cannot discern which are Anjali's and which belong to the sky god. I back up, toward Ashwin, and a wind whips at my ankles. I fall, dropping my dagger. Another squall lashes my back. The sting goes through my tunic to my skin. Then another strike belts me, followed by Anjali's laugh. She whips me again with her slicing gusts. My tunic rips, exposing my back. Another few agonizing lashes come. Welts rise on my skin. I roll over and throw repeated heat waves to make her stop. The color of my flames starts out a lime green and steadily intensifies to emerald. Her flaying winds peter off, and nature's less punishing gales skim over me. Snow presses into my back and cools the pain. Where are Inda and Pons? Burners are supposed to be the most dangerous of us, Anjali says, standing over me. I reach for my dagger, but a wind pushes my arm above my head. Anjali stomps on my other arm, pinning my fire powers against the frozen ground. Leave us be, I say. Killing us will not stop Uduk. My father has given me everything good in my life. I do as he asks. She leans over me and grabs my neck. First, you die, and then the prince. The wind on my raised arm has passed. I swing it down and seize her wrist. I'll turn you into an ash heap first. I accept that challenge. Her powers dive inside me and squeeze my chest. She winnows my lungs, shriveling my breath and stealing my sky. But our skin-to-skin connection goes both ways. I thread out her soul fire, parching her. Her lips and skin dull to gray, yet she holds on. The loss of air weakens my grip. I must breathe. A streak darts across my vision. Ashwin shoves Anjali off me and swings his machete at her. She lobs a wind at his weaponized arm, and it involuntarily goes over his head. While his blade is restrained, she captures his throat with her hands. Ashwin stills and shudders. I funnel my powers into a burning ball and toss my emerald fire, now blue at the edges. Anjali's free hand summons a wind that casts my sphere of flames into the trees. My odd, sickly fire devours the underbrush. The northern wind picks up the embers and showers the forest with them. Sparks grow to flames that spread despite the cold. Ashwin shoves and kicks at Anjali. He breaks free, panting, and she grabs him again. I hurl my dagger at her, burying the blade into her leg. She screams, but does not release him. I pull my second dagger, and a huge chunk of ice smashes into me. Pain bursts down my spine. I fall forward, dropping my dagger, hands deep in frost. I reach for my weapon, but flying icicles impede my path. Behind me, Indira, a rebel aquifer, throws her icy blades. I roll away from them, farther from my weapon. And then Indira is on me, her cold hands wrapped around my wrists. Her powers flow inside me and sing a song to my blood that entrances the rivers of my veins. She pulls, and like a tide following the moon, droplets bleed from my body. Her powers lock me in place, like a leaf caught in a whirlpool. From the corner of my eye, I see Anjali still winnowing Ashwin. His arms turn limp, and his struggles lessen. My blood cries tears across my skin. Its irony wetness seeps into my mouth and nose. My heartbeat slows to muted thuds, and my vision dims. Ashwin's eyes roll back into his head. Mine start to do the same. My inner star pierces my haze. Indira is draining my lifeblood, but also depleting the cold inside me. I pulse my dwindling soul fire at her, sending forth a burst of scorching heat. She tumbles off me, shrieking, her robes on fire. Behind her, the forest is ablaze. Indira rolls around on the ground into the flames. The fire sweeps over her, and her shrieks and frantic movements stop. Winded and dizzy, I climb to my knees. Flecks of blood cover my exposed skin. Dark stars sweep across my vision, blending into the sky. What did Indira do to me? Anjali releases Ashwin, and he sags in a lifeless heap. No. Anu, no. She jerks my dagger from her thigh and tosses it, then rides a swift wind and lands in front of me. Anjali snatches my throat, and her powers crush my lungs. Having spent all my fire on Indira, I clutch the Gaeler's arms with a weak, useless grip. I burned your father's journals, used them as kindling. Anjali's winnowing powers unfold into my limbs, siphoning out every last bit of breath. Consider it payback for betraying my father. I weep inwardly for the loss of my father's journals. I will never read his thoughts, never see my mother through his eyes. Never know them for myself. The forest fire blazes, lighting up Anjali's silhouette. My powers that sparked the inferno have grown wild into nature fire. Serpents slither in the flames. Come to me, friends. None heed me. Please, I need you. They continue their crazed overtaking of the forest. Ashwin has not moved. I will be next. Where are Inda and Pons? I latch on to the only weapon within my reach, Udug's cold fire. I summon it as I would my powers. Sapphire sparks shoot from my fingers. Anjali releases me with a shriek. I land on all fours, coughing in loose chunks of air. Pons and Inga charge into the clearing. Both bleed from cuts on their faces. Pons aims with his blowgun and shoots 3 darts at Anjali in swift succession. She diverts them into the fire with well-timed gusts. Anjali stumbles away, favoring her wounded leg. Inda stays back, the cold frustrating her powers, but Pons stalks closer. The forest fire hedges Anjali in. Pons fastens his winds into a whip and lashes at her. While I stay low, she rallies her own drafts against him. Across the way, Ashwin has not stirred. He's too still. Pons and Anjali fling their powers at each other. The sky crackles, their airstreams clash, and a clap blasts above me. Lying on the cold ground, I cover my ears. Anjali falters a step. Pons's winds push her back to the wall of fire. Anjali emits a guttural cry and ducks. His airstream blows past her into the trees, picking up flames and pitching them into the distance. Anjali commandeers the northern wind and flies over me. She heaves a chakram at Pons. He dodges the spinning blade, and she soars over him and Inda. He chases her with lancing airstreams. Anjali dashes into the smoke, out of sight. Inda runs to me, scrapes across her forehead and cheeks. We tried to get here sooner. The northern aquifer iced the courtyard gate shut and attacked us with icicles. Help, Ashwin, I croak, rubbing my hoarse throat. She hurries to the prince. Pons comes over, collecting my daggers along the way, and helps me to the lake. Slashes from Indira's attack run up his forearms. I rest near the icy shore, and he returns to assist Inda with Ashwin. Pons lugs him over his shoulder. As they cross back to me, a streak of white zips into the sky. Anjali takes off aboard our wing flyer, vanishing into the night. She will return to her father and report that she winnowed the prince to death. Anu, spare him. Pons lays Ashwin down on the rocky lake shore. Though he does not wake, his chest rises and falls. I send up a prayer of thanks, but we are not out of harm's way. We have to put out the fire. Inda reaches for the lake, but the water is trapped under the ice. My own powers are spent, and I cannot wait for them to recover. Teeth clacking, I look down at Ashwin. Stealing another soul fire to increase my own is wrong, but I need my powers to stop the fire from reaching the temple. Gods forgive me. I touch Ashwin and tug in his white-hot light. Warmth pours into my chest and fills up my heart. Not too much. You'll hurt him. But his soul fire is so warm. Kalinda! Inda wrenches my hand from him. After a horrified look at me, she checks him over. Ashwin is still breathing. I have what I need. Favoring my knee, I dash off. Heat rolls off the nature fire, roaring with fiery serpents. Shh, my friends. Sleep. They rage onward to the temple, the unrelenting northern winds pushing them to and fro. Pons runs up alongside me, diverting the smoke with his winds.
You need to send the nature fire away.
I'm trying, I say, and then cry at the flames. I am fire, and fire is me. I reach out with my powers, but my hands glow a cold, pale sapphire. None of my soul fire is visible within me, only this cruel blue. The fire is beyond my control.
Pons, we have to get everyone out.
We sprint through the gate, past chunks of ice from when Pons and Inda hacked their way free. Priestess Mita ushers girls out the main entry into the courtyard. Several of the younger ones know Pons, and they rush to his side. He scoops the littlest up in his arms. Healer Baka comes with more wards. A stream of girls and sisters races for the lake. Everyone has gotten out. Priestess Mita would not leave a single girl behind. The fire snaps closer and closer. I attempt to quell it one last time. Priestess Mita gasps at my glowing blue hands. Please, Anu, please. I concentrate so hard my head aches. But the nature fire will not obey. Priestess Mita and I dart outside the gate. She rounds on me.
You're an abomination. You brought this destruction upon our heads.
Her beliefs about Buddhas are wrong, but I have no justification. My powers did this. I started this firestorm. Smoke stings my watery eyes. Hungry flames chew onward, the wildfire feasting without restraint. All my years with Jaya are slowly leveling to ash. Are the gods punishing me for going against the claiming? I only wanted men, especially men like Tarek, to lose their right to these girls. I never wanted this. A shadowy figure appears nearby on the road. Tarek has come to witness the desecration of the gods' sanctuary. The back of my throat cramps as the fire climbs through the north tower and devours the beacon in its cinder teeth. Anu, send him away. If you have any mercy, you won't let him revel in my pain. But Tarek delights in the cruelty of the night, smiling not at the fire, but at me.
18. Devon. The soldiers who earned the coin and bottle of Apong sing rowdily across the way. My unit rests on the ground against the catapult wheels. I am dirty, sweaty, and so tired the campfire embers look like lanterns floating off into the sky. I could do with a long pull from that Apong bottle. But I settle for the dirty cup of water and charred flatbread a meal server brought around. Yathen sits alone and stares into the rocky plain while flexing his hand into a fist over and over. He and Natasha have not spoken since we left the village. Rowan eats quietly, his gaze jumping around so often my own nerves crackle. No one has come looking for the missing soldier, but that could still change. A mild western wind swirls through camp, flowing from the barren region ahead. At our pressing pace, we will reach the Bahavia Desert the day after tomorrow, a full day ahead of schedule. Natasha itches her neck. How do you wear these? We take our turbans off at night, I say. How fortunate for you. She scratches harder. I'm not used to sleeping with something on my head. You'll have to make sure I don't rip it off and throw it into the fire. The group of drunkards across camp bursts into laughter. Rowan jogs his knee. His hunger to search for his sister will not be satiated tonight. When it gets late, I'll take a stroll around camp alone, I tell him. Rowan sits taller. I should go with you and keep an ear out. I can determine how upset he is by how often his voice breaks. That was 3 times. It would be suspicious for us to wander around together. After today, we have to be selective about our risks.
You mean after you nearly got us caught?
Rowan grumbles. I won't repeat my mistake. I promise. Have you heard anything?
No.
Rowan crosses arms, his frown understandable. I lower my voice between us. If Brock and Opal are indeed in camp, we'll find them. Please wait here while I'm gone.
Is that an order?
Rowan's voice pitched only once, but it was so apparent Yatin glances over. I'm asking for your trust. After my prolonged stare, Rowan concedes with a begrudging mumble. Natasha stretches out her legs.
I'm fine right here.
She sneaks a tentative glance at Yatin, seated at the end of the wagon. His aloofness bothers her, but she leaves him be. I stride over to him. How are you faring? Yatin glowers at his fist, his sight in line with my boots.
Natasha shouldn't have taken her turban off today. She risked too much.
I pursed my lips and thought. I doubt she sees it that way. Natasha's a sister warrior. She was trained to stand up for herself and those she loves. Yatin unclenches his fist, and I spot the lotus ring in his palm. Holding on to it must be adding to his unrest.
You should propose to her again.
She may give you a different answer.
She's stubborn. Be more stubborn.
Yatin grunts noncommittally and slips the ring into his pocket. The noises around camp have lessened. The men are turning in for the night. I pat his shoulder and then walk back to the others. Natasha is by herself. Where did Rowan go? I ask. She picks dirt out from under her nails.
He needed the latrine.
Keep an eye on him and Yatin while I'm gone.
Are you assigning me to watch duty, General?
Why does everyone take what I say as an order?
You can call it that if you prefer, I thumb at Yatin. He's worried about you.
No, he's mad that I took off my turban. But we would have been caught. At the very least, you would have. Kali would burn us alive if anything happens to you.
I'm not so certain she cares, I admit.
Don't be a dolt. Of course she does.
Natasha thumps my shin, a friendly bump. I return her badgering with a nudge of my toe. She does not smile.
Yatin wants to marry me.
Oh?
You're an awful liar, Devon. I know Yatin told you. He doesn't understand why I want to meet his family first, because he has a family. But it matters to me.
Natasha hugs her knees to her chest and tries unsuccessfully not to glance at him.
He wants you for his wife, I reply. He already considers you a part of his family.
She loosens some.
You better go before Rowan comes back and talks you into taking him along. Be careful.
You too.
I pick up my empty water cup, salute her in farewell, and head off. I maneuver through the sleepy camp, careful not to draw much attention. The soldiers have settled in tents or lain out under wagons. To keep up the appearance that I am out for a drink, I stop at the watering hole. No one pays me any mind as I down a cup of stale water and head off in a direction opposite to the one I came from. Since we have not found any sign of prisoners, the demon Raja must be keeping them close by, so I set out in search of his tent. Near the front of camp, the covered wagons multiply. At the end of a long row, the demon Raja's grand silk tent is pitched. Manas ducks out the tent's entry. I flatten against a wagon and he strides to the far end of the nearest row. I start after Manas. Heaviness burdens my approach, and a high signal drones in my ears, as though I am standing too close to a ringing gong. I close in on the tent, and a thick, cloying darkness permeates the night. Even the torchlights do not shine as far. A blue light flashes from inside the tent, and a sudden tremor shakes the ground. Then stunning quiet. Cold fingers pry at my chest. That quake came from a trembler. Ignoring the fear simmering in my gut, I tiptoe down the row of wagons, navigating the gloom to my advantage. A shadow moves in front of me. Someone else sneaks to the wagon at the end of the second row. I recognize the person's small, slight shape and whisper his name. Rowan pauses, the only indication that he heard me, and carries on. I hiss for him to come back, but he tiptoes closer to the last covered wagon. Skies above, I should have ordered him to remain with Natasha and Yatin. I dart to the line of wagons and nestle in the shadows. A swift, suspicious gust ruffles the draped opening of the Demon Raja's tent and knocks over a lamp within. Two guards and Manas dash inside to stomp out the fire. Rowan must have caused the sudden wind. He hurries for the wagon nearest the tent. I stop at the front of the wagon, by the coachman's bench, and peer around the corner. Rowan hovers at the corner of the covered wagon's rear door.
Opal?
He whispers. I strain my ears but hear nothing. Manas will have weakened the Buddha prisoners by poisoning them with white baneberry and snake root, or by bleeding out their powers. A muffled voice comes from inside the wagon.
Rowan?
Opal. I listen for Brock, but another voice calls out.
General, says the demon Udug and Tarek's stolen timbre. We have a visitor. Manas and two soldiers armed with crossbows race out of the tent.
Rowan summons a raging gust, and the opulent tent starts to lift off the ground. Furniture tips over, and lamplight flickers. Both soldiers release bolts. Rowan's wind diverts the first one, but the second strikes him in the shoulder. Rowan falls, and his winds dwindle.
"Bind him," says Manas.
The soldiers tie Rowan's wrists behind him with a vine of toxic snake root, and the last of his powers recede. In the stillness, the Deban Raja strides out of his tent.
"You're audacious, boy."
Udu's snide voice rings with amusement.
"Are you alone?"
Rowan bends over, in pain from the bolt in his shoulder.
"You have my sister."
"You mean Opal."
Udug elongates the O and snaps the P. Opal.
"Your sister has proven to be very valuable."
Manas speaks up. "This boy served as a guard for kindred Kalinda and Prince Ashwin."
"Oh?"
Udug looms over Rowan as he would a drooping flower.
"How are my son and first wife? Have they run into any further trouble?"
My stomach plunges. He must mean the Sea Raiders. Did they follow the Navy or Kali and the Prince? Rowan groans through firm-set teeth.
"Release Opal. Take me."
"I have no need for two abominations."
The Demon Raja grabs Rowan's head as he did when he executed the Galer.
"Anu, don't let this be happening."
Rowan also recognizes the fatal grip and toughens to someone sager than his 14 years.
"Prince Ashwin is our true ruler. He and kindred Kalinda will stop you."
His boldness tugs at my pride. His voice did not break once.
"You will not live to see how wrong you are."
Udug's fingers glow in eerie azure as his fingertips dig into Rowan's head.
"I cast you out, demon."
Rowan's expression fixes in a silent scream. White light, his soul fire, filters out of him and into the demon's grasp. Pounding sounds from inside the wagon. Opal bangs against the door, her shouts indistinct.
"I have to get to Rowan.
Perhaps I could dispatch Manas and one of the guards before the other releases a bolt at me. But could I cut down all three? And then how do I stop Udug? All my muscles strain for me to step forward, to protect Rowan, to stop Udug, to do something. But Opal's wailing holds me back. I promised Rowan I would save his sister. Revealing my presence would jeopardize my chance of keeping my word. Any attempt to save Rowan would put Opal, Natasha, and Yatin in danger, and by all reason would be suicide. I cannot do anything for Rowan. But I can still help Opal." Dropping my head against the side of the wagon, I fight the need to act. Why couldn't Rowan have listened to me and stayed behind? Why didn't he trust me? I should have known he lied to Natasha about needing the latrine. I should have stayed at the wagon until he returned. I failed him. I failed us all. The night transforms around Udug, thickening to a suffocating depth of nothing. Rowan's soul fire fades like a dying day. I grasp my sword so tightly my palm aches. Finally, Udug steals the last of Rowan's essence and lets him go. Rowan folds in a heap like a husk, limbs and head angled wrongly. Opal's frantic thuds and cries lessen. Udug stares up at the sky and scowls at the stars that defy his darkness. Then he strides into his tent. Manas wrenches the bolt from Rowan's shoulder. I cringe from the grisly sound of blade ripping flesh.
"Get rid of it."
The soldiers pick up Rowan and lug him away. Opal's weeps reverberate into my bones. Manas wraps his fist against the wagon.
"You in there, shut it."
he mutters to himself and ducks inside Udug's tent. I wait 2 breaths, then 5, then 12. No one returns. Opal's cries continue. Brock must not be with her, or I would have heard him by now. Perhaps Udug stole his soul fire too. The pair of soldiers returns and stands guard at the end of the prisoner's wagon. I press my lips against the wall and whisper so only the wind can hear me. I'll get you out, Opal. I swear it. Trusting the wind to deliver my message, I slip away to the end of camp. The moon and stars reveal 2 sets of footprints leading into the rocky field. I follow their trail to the body. The soldiers dumped Rowan in the grass. They did not even lay him so he looks to the heavens. I roll him onto his back and sniffle away my tears. He was so young. Without a tool to dig a grave with, I will lay him to rest another way. I set to work gathering rocks, taking off my jacket to use as a bindle. I load and carry 4 or 5 rocks at a time. I stack them around Rowan, burying his feet and legs first. A rustle in the grass draws me up short. Scavengers must have caught the scent of the body. Before long they will circle in. I double my speed, gathering and stacking until Rowan is encased in stones. I kneel back, sweat dripping down my forehead, and try to center myself. My anger against Udug drove me to labor through most of the night, but I must let go of my hard feelings long enough to pray. Gods, bless Rowan's soul so that he may find the gate that leads to peace and everlasting light. I recite the prayer of rest more often than feels fair, but the blessing always instills harmony in my heart. I sit with Rowan until sunrise stirs on the horizon. Then I leave him to his rest, and trudge back to our catapult wagon. Yatin and Natasha are wide awake, sitting upright beside each other. Rowan didn't return, Natasha says. Her lower lip is red from gnawing it. Tears I thought I left at the gravesite burn my eyes. He found Opal locked in a wagon. The demon Raja got to him first. Natasha's expression crashes in as she succumbs to shock and sorrow. I slide to the ground and drop my head in my hands.
And Brock?
Yatin asks. My shoulders curve over my hollow chest. No sign of him. Yatin and Natasha fall quiet. We alone cannot stop Udug. We are 3 mortals against an immortal demon. We could sneak off now as though we were never here. We could steal horses and run for Vani ahead of the army, or backtrack and seek out the Listerian navy along the river. But my vow to Opal stops me, and despite my better instincts, I muster the fortitude not to flee. I'm staying, I say. You 2 can leave. Natasha draws short breaths, working up the nerve to run, or hide, or both. Yatin wraps his arm around her, and she leans into his side.
We need to stay together, he says.
My heart fills until it may burst. They still trust me, even after my terrible mistake. I thought Rowan would regard my plea for him to stay with the others. I should have commanded him not to leave, but I refused to take full responsibility for his life. And now I am partly responsible for his death. I will not repeat my error. If you stay, you stay on as my troops. I leave no quarrel about my authority. You'll do everything I order. No questions, no debates. You follow me. Yatin does not so much as blink.
Yes, sir.
Yes, General Naik, Natasha amends. Her use of my rank rubs at an old sore. But I let it alone and rest against the wagon for what is left of the night. Daybreak gradually pours across the grassland, stinging my tired eyes and waking the troops. I could sleep through the ruckus, but sunup pushes us to get underway. My unit packs up. The loss of our fourth member is stark as we divide the work to ready our horses and wagon. I would like to visit Rowan's gravesite before we leave, bring Natasha and Yatin along, and allow myself another moment to rage about his death. But the wagons ahead of us roll out. So we set off for another grueling day of marching.
19. Kalinda. I stare, bleary-eyed, at the smoking rubble. Snowflakes drift down upon the smoldering piles of stone and melt to steam. The fire flattened the structure in the night, dancing like cackling demons around a pyre. This charred wreckage is all that remains of the Samia Temple. A low, whitewashed sky has long since lightened to the bleakest gray, casting an abysmal glare over the scene. The 100 or so temple wards huddle as one in the crisp cold. In their rush to escape the fire, few sisters and wards brought cloaks. Flakes of ash entwine with the snowflakes and tarnish the sisters' humble blue robes. Frightened and saddened tears clean trails down the wards' sooty faces. The older girls comfort the younger ones, and the sisters comfort the older girls. The wards are too distraught to do little more than steal astonished glances at the men, and the sisters do not stop them. In the wake of this devastation, they do not fear the loss of innocence. I am the enemy they dread. Priestess Mita huddles with the sisters to discuss what they should do next. Our situation is beyond desolate. By the time Inda and Pons chipped a hole in the icy lake and she sent streams of water at the temple, the inferno was ravenous. My fault. Shifting off my bad leg, I shiver against the wind. The ache in my knee has returned, digging in with frozen claws. Pons and Inda wait down shore, the aquifer having healed their cuts and the welts on my back. Ashwin broods by the lake, holding a chunk of ice to the back of his head. We have yet to speak, and I can hardly look at him. Does he remember I stole his soul fire? The remnants of his parched warmth lasted until a few hours ago, and Udug's cold poison took charge once more. But for a few merciful hours, I felt whole. I cram my chilly fingers under my arms, but I have little body heat left to share. Take some soul fire from one of the wards, just enough to drive back the cold. No. Living off another's essence is a base, disgusting kind of survival. Ilabaka separates from the group of sisters and comes to me. Are you feeling better, Kalinda? I'm fine. How is everyone else? A few bruises from our evacuation. But as a whole, well. Snowflakes melt on Healer Baka's spectacles, but the droplets do not interrupt her avid stare. The prince blames himself for this. I huff a dry laugh. He doesn't deserve that, right? The glory of this is all mine. This was an accident, Kalinda. Baka rotates me away from the other sisters' direct view. They've voted for the prince, your friends, and you to leave. But our wing flyer was taken, I say, planting my heels. And Inda sent for aid, the Listarians will come with rations. We should wait here for them, together. Healer Baka wraps one arm around me. Priestess Mita wants you and your companions to start down the mountain. We'll send the Listarians for you after they arrive. I jerk from her hold. The sisters and wards should know the truth. Buddhas are good. Don't send us away or they'll fear my kind. Priestess Mita speaks from behind us. They should fear you. Healer Baka and I whirl around. The priestess's glare ties my thoughts into a jumble of apologies, rendering me speechless. You're no sister warrior, and you're not my kindred. Leave this place and take the Listarian abominations with you. I am unsurprised that she would cast aside Buddhas, but her disrespect for Ashwin unknots my tongue. What of the prince? He's your ruler.
My ruler is Raja Tarak, Priestess Mita corrects. He leads the empire, not the prince.
I reel on Baka.
You told her?
She extends an apologetic grimace.
As you said, they deserve to know the truth. Anu sent Raja Tarak back to save us, Priestess Mita rails on. He will preserve our sacred rites and finish exterminating your kind.
Her gullibility floors me.
The gods never send souls back. They send them forward to their next life. The Raja isn't Tarak, he's a demon in disguise.
She screws her lips up like I am a piece of filth on her tongue.
You have no place to brand anyone a demon, slag.
Baka gasps at the priestess's use of the derogatory term for a burner. I am flabbergasted they even know it. Priestess Mita lifts her voice louder, unashamed of her contempt.
Go from here before the gods strike you down for the ruin you have brought upon these faithful sisters and wards.
I tense my body to ward off my shaking.
These wards should know who they're following. Raja Tarak is a go,
bellows the priestess.
Go and take your lies and corruption with you.
Healer Baka speaks.
Mita. Hush, Baka.
The priestess directs the full force of her animosity at her instead.
Either you side with us or you leave.
The healer deflates. I'm sorry, Kali. The wards need me. I need you too. I bite off the admission and seek a softening of heart from the sisters behind them, but they are united in their dismissal. Sarita steps forward, little ones at her side.
Kalinda?
Take me with you.
You're needed here,
I rasp, my emotions clogging my throat. The girls with Sarita stare up at me. I bend down to speak to them. Despite the priestess's claim that I am demonic, they abide my presence. Stay with Sarita and Healer Baka. They'll keep you safe. After I muster an encouraging smile for Sarita, I trudge across the snow to Ashwin. We've been asked to leave, but they cannot make us.
No more contention,
Ashwin replies, rubbing at a headache.
We'll go.
He starts for the road, and Pons and Inda follow. I lock in a shout. Why is Ashwin listening to the sisters? He's their rightful leader. I squeeze my fists at my side and trail him down the road. Pons wraps his arm around Inda, and she leans against him. I cannot tell if she is sick again or simply exhausted from our horrible night. Whatever the case may be, she needs to rest. She should not be trekking down a snowy mountain. My anger pushes like a blade into my gut. I stomp up to Ashwin.
Are you giving in?
Does it appear that way?
You're feeling sorry for yourself. You should be thinking of our people.
He addresses me, his walk swift. A ruler doesn't force himself upon his people. He cannot demand that they love or respect him. Besides, the priestess is right to send us away. We invited rebel deceivers here and they destroyed the temple.
So that's it. You're going to let them think the demon masquerading as your father is a better leader than you?
Ashwin comes to an abrupt halt.
Who are you angry at, Kalinda? The priestess for sending you away? Me for not caring? Yourself for burning down your childhood home?
I throw a small flame into the air between us, and he jumps back.
You're Tarek's son, with or without me. Accept your fate and claim your throne. Stop pitying yourself!
I am my father's son, but that doesn't entitle you to speak to me so.
You've never been the exact image of your father until just now. His gaze flattens to a wall.
And you're his murderess.
Inda wedges in between us.
Stop it. You're like dragons snapping at each other's gullets.
She clutches her stomach and my temper dissolves to concern. Inda covers her mouth. Heaving into her hand, she runs for a shrub alongside the road. Pons strides over to her. I fire a glare at Ashwin for letting the priestess bully us into leaving. Inda's condition is his fault. She finishes retching and wipes her mouth on her sleeve.
Why didn't you tell me you're ill? Ashwin asks.
I'm not ill.
I'm with child, Inda replies.
Ashwin and I stare openly.
Pons and I have known for a while. I'm more than 5 moons along.
Her explanation adds to my amazement. She was with child when she traveled to Iresh to fight in the trial tournament. Why didn't you say anything?
My father will be angry, she whispers.
Pons tugs her in close.
Perhaps at first, he says. But he'll praise Anki once he's a grandfather. He loves you and he will love our child.
Ashwin fidgets with his gold cuff. Our gazes meet, and once again I can envision his dream for us. The dream I stomped all over. His dejection is still too fresh, too visible. I have to look away. A sudden northern wind arises, twirling down the road the way we came. Pons tilts his ear to the sky, and his eyes progressively widen. What is it? I ask.
Come along.
He leads Inda back the direction we came. Ashwin and I hustle after them, following the smoke spiraling into the sky, around the bend in the road to Samia. A Mahati falcon, feathers rich red with orange undertones and yellow tips, circles the site of the fire. Its master rides the giant bird on a woven saddle. Her silvery hair flies behind her, striking as lightning against her sepia skin. The falcon screeches as it dives. The sisters and wards scatter and hide in the unburned section of forest. The great bird, its body large as a wagon and its wingspan 3 wagons wide, lands near the ice-covered lake. Tinli, the daughter of Chief Naresh of Paljor, dismounts her falcon. Her crossbow, her favored weapon while she competed against Inda and me in the trial tournament, is strapped to her back. Tinli was eliminated during the first trial, but I believe we parted on amiable terms. At least, that is how I recall our time together. The Gaeler surveys the woods for the frightened women and wards. Tinli still wears a sarong, and a high slit emphasizes her long, slim legs. A single strip of cloth is wound around her chest. The only change in her appearance is her bearskin cloak. Tinli taps her talon-like nail against her bottom lip and considers me. I saw the smoke trail while I was patrolling the border. You wouldn't have anything to do with this disaster, would you, Kalinda? I try not to take offense at her teasing, but her humor is too close to the mark. She evaluates my downturned mouth and dips her head sideways at Ashwin, her usual reluctant bow. Your Majesty, God's grace to you and your kindred. When is your wedding? We're not getting married, I say, ignoring Ashwin's grimace. Are you planning another trial tournament? Tinli demands. Because I'm not competing. No disrespect, Your Majesty, but I'm content patrolling the skies. Marriage would only bind my wings.
We aren't arranging another tournament, Ashwin assures her. As you can see, we're in no state for such designs. We need your help.
Tinli strokes her Mahati falcon's side. I sent out a message for the nearest patrol vessel when I first smelt the smoke. They should arrive shortly. Her milky eyes, like 2 moons, turn to the clouds. And here they come.
A huge shadow pushes through the overcast sky. The vessel, larger than those in the Lestarian Navy, floats on a tremendous wind and boasts 3 masts decorated with countless sails, a patchwork of varying shades of blue. The quilted sails are not confined to the top of the ship, but also extend as wings. The stern is elongated, like a bird's tail, and sports even more sails, akin to tail feathers. The Paljorians have mimicked their revered Mahati falcons for the vessel's design, with a bird figurehead fronting a sleek hull and high prow. Gaelers on deck direct gusts into the bulging sails, propelling the craft forward. More gaelers maneuver airstreams under the hull, suspending the ship high above ground. Winds disperse the smoke plumes and toss my hair.
The airship flies over us, tucking its wings close to the hull, and lands in a clearing near the lake. Its crew lower 4 clamp-like feet to stabilize the rounded hull on the ground. A plank drops from the port side, in front of the wing, and a man disembarks. Though his long, straight hair is white as a new star, his physique is strapping. His arms protrude beneath a loose tunic and the russet bearskin draped over his shoulders. His low-cut collar shows a sliver of his deeply tanned chest. A short skirt hangs above his thighs, which rise and dip like valleys and mountains. Ashwin greets the older man.
Chief Naresh, I recognize you from a portrait I saw years past. You haven't aged a day. You must be referring to the rendition in the history text. I had that portrait commissioned before you could walk, Prince Ashwin.
The chief's eyes twinkle. His language drags a little, and he drops his long vowels. Tinley's accent is the same, but her father's is more pronounced. The chief's light brown eyes dart to me.
Galinda Zacharias.
Beaming, he hauls me into a breath-stealing hug. Chief Naresh leans away, and his gaze roves over me as though seeing a long-lost friend.
You have your mother's hair and your father's sure-footed stature. Kishan was a great man, and Yasmin was the bravest sister warrior of her time. Their love was a bridge between Buddhas and mankind. I mourned their passing.
This demonstrative, complimentary man is not what I expected, considering his daughter is more frigid than a midwinter wind. His affection for my parents eases my envy that he knew them, while I will never have that privilege. Chief Naresh greets Pons and Inda with more hearty embraces, then says,
Come aboard where it's warmer.
He raises his voice to the women and girls in the woods.
All are welcome.
Priestess Mita, well within hearing range, can judge for herself that the chief's invitation is genuine, but she does not budge. The sisters and wards loiter too, wary of the Mahati falcon ruffling its fiery feathers in the numbing cold. They're afraid of Buddhas, I explain. Chief Naresh winks at me and speaks louder.
Then they must decide which they fear more, Buddhas or freezing to death.
With that ominous choice, he ascends the ship's plank with great hefty strides. Inda and Pons go after him. Priestess Mita waves insistently at Ashwin.
Don't go, Your Majesty. They're Paljorians. They let their birds live with them and their women betroth themselves to men when they're just little children.
Our women aren't locked away in a henhouse, Tinley drawls. We let them strut about the yard with any rooster they like. Color flares across Priestess Mita's collarbone.
Your Majesty.
Ashwin bats a finger at Tinley, requesting her forbearance. She growls through bared teeth and stalks aboard the ship.
I ask that you not use my formal title, Priestess, Ashwin says. From you, it's a mockery.
She pulls back in offense, and Ashwin marches up the plank. I signal the girls in the forest to come forward. Sarita picks up a child and steps out, undeterred by the giant falcon peering at her with glassy eyes.
Sarita,
the priestess calls.
Get back here.
She remains on course. I'm going to get warm and hopefully find something to eat. At the prospect of shelter and food, more wards dash after her for the airship. Healer Baka leads 2 little girls out, her head high. After a tense stare-off with the priestess, even Sister Hatol quits the woods. Their parting prompts an exodus. The rest of the wards and sisters rush for the airship, leaving the priestess behind. Sarita starts up the plank. Do you think Priestess Mita will realize she's excessively pig-headed? Gods, as my witness, I don't care. I whisk ahead, climbing aboard in search of elusive warmth.
20. Devon. Our horse team stumbles up another dune, spraying sand in my eyes. We ascend the slippery rise halfway, and then the catapult mires in the sand and jerks to a halt. From the time we set out this morning, we have intermittently charged across the hot sand and spun our wheels. Like the gods, the desert is no respecter of man. I urge the horse team up the dune while Yatin and Natesha push the catapult from behind. Our sleepless night slows our ascent, but we trudge onward.
Come on! Come on!
My half-plea, half-prayer encourages the horses to conquer the sand dune. Overlooking the landscape, I squint at the sunburnt dunes rolling into the distance. Our troops trek up and down them like organized lines of red ants. I collect my breath and guide our horses and wagon over the ridge to descend the other side. Sweat trickles into my eyes. I swipe the stream away with my arm, also slick from perspiration, and smear grit across my brow. Soldiers trudge alongside us, their headscarves shielding their mouths and noses from the sun and sand. I pinned my headscarf across the lower half of my face, as did Yatin and Natesha. She was elated to discard the turban this morning and pick up a headscarf in the last village before the desert. There we united with a legion of Imperial soldiers waiting to join our march on Vani. With them, our ranks have swelled to 10,000 men, maybe a few hundred more. Our growing numbers have allayed some of my anxiousness about being discovered. But I am still on edge. The soldier Yatin dispatched with his holiday was reported missing. A gossipy water server alluded to suspicions that the man deserted, but Manas may not be so quick to dismiss his disappearance. My unit rallies and starts the climb over the next sand dune. On a parallel rise, another wagon becomes stuck. I spot Manas on his horse coaching a team of men to dislodge the wagon. Eager to get ahead of them, I yank harder on the harness. My arms quiver from urging on the horses, but soon we exceed the elevation of the other wagon. Nearer to the steep ridge, our wheels sink into the sand. The wagon slides sideways down the incline, and the top-heavy catapult tips. The horses stumble backward with the heavy wagon, snorting and braying. I dig my heels and skid with them. Shouts ring out, and soldiers rush over to stabilize us. Hands and backs wedge against the leaning side. Yatin props himself under the shadow of the tilting artillery. Natesha relieves me of the reins so I can join him. My feet slip, but more soldiers help to steady the catapult. Frozen at an angle, the wagon continues to drift. The men at the back push up and stop the wagon's descent, but it is still tipping. The catapult will land on them and take out the soldiers in its path downhill.
We need weight, I say. Yatin, jump on the high side.
He goes around the wagon and climbs onto the catapult. His weight lowers the raised wheels some. Another three men leap on, and the wagon drops onto the sand. The men jump off, and our unit finishes hauling the catapult up and over the dune. Down in the trench, Yatin, Natesha, and I collapse against the wagon, breathless and sun-worn. The same commander that assigned us to man the catapult trots up on his horse.
Well done, soldiers.
I wipe my clammy brow with my headscarf, cleaning the grit from my eyes.
Just doing our duty, sir.
He calls for a water server. Natesha pets the horses, her gaze downcast. She cannot drink without removing her headscarf. So she waves the server off. I down half my cup.
May I keep this?
I ask the commander. We usually return our cups for reuse, but I want to reserve the rest of my drink for Natesha.
You've earned it,
the commander says, then looks to an officer riding to us.
Gods almighty, Manas.
Natesha maneuvers around the horses, tending to their bridles. Yatin hovers at the fringe of my vision, his broad shoulders bunching. I let the brim of my headscarf fall to my eyebrows, the cloth still pinned across my lower face.
Commander,
Manas says by way of greeting.
Well done saving the catapult. This is the soldier you should thank.
The commander motions at me. I bow. Manas's stare bores into me with the severity of the afternoon sun.
You've crossed this desert before, Manas remarks.
I nod, my head still lowered to conceal my eyes.
What's your name?
I need a name. Any name.
I blurt out the first one my mind latches onto.
Chit. We're missing an officer, Chit. You seem to be the vigilant sort. Did you see an officer?